just working prototypes of exotic, highly advanced technology. Self-driving speedsters, one-man submarines, robots, ovens that cooked entire meals at the touch of a button. The amazing Oliver Ward show invited people to see the future. It had been a great publicity hook. The advance press releases had played up the educational aspect of the performances, which inspired parents to take their children to the show. Science teachers across the country had encouraged their students to attend. Afterward, there were invariably front-page stories in the local papers rhapsodizing about the futuristic engineering marvels witnessed on stage. Of course, after the disaster, the press had taken a different tack. The mystery of what went wrong with Oliver Ward's final performance had made headlines for weeks. Eventually, the reporters moved on to other sensational stories. But the question surrounding the bloody end of one of the world's most famous magic acts had achieved something close to legendary status. It was his own fault, Oliver thought. Speculation had run wild primarily because he flatly refused to discuss the subject. In addition, he forbade his employees to talk about the disaster. "You know, in the length of time it will take you to print out just the front page of one of those radio newspapers, you can read the Burning Cove Herald and several L.A. papers as well," Oliver said. He held up the copy of Hollywood Whispers that he had picked up at the front desk. "This was delivered to the hotel 15 minutes ago, for example." "Oh, technology!" Chester shouted. He patted the massive waist-high radio with its screeching printer. "In the future, you won't have to wait for the news to be printed and distributed. It will be delivered directly into every home and office by one of these babies." The shrill screech ended abruptly. Oliver exhaled in relief. He watched Chester remove the freshly printed page. "Here you go." Beaming like a proud father showing off his firstborn, Chester held out the printed page. "This just in from a small radio station a few miles up the coast. They've agreed to work with me on the testing phase." Oliver looked at the page. The headline read, "Test." The story was short. "Weather sunny and warm." "There's no news," Oliver said.
"Course not. Still running tests."
"The ink is still wet. No one's going to want to read a wet paper. And at the rate it was printing, it's going to take a very long time to get the front page out of the machine." Chester grunted, his bushy brows scrunched together.
"The slow speed of the printer and the fact that the ink needs time to dry are problems, but I'm working on them."
He looked up and squinted at the headline of Whispers.
"What's it say?"
Oliver read the headline aloud. "Actress found dead in Burning Cove Hotel Spa. Was it murder?"
"Well, damn," Chester muttered. "That reporter lady didn't waste any time, did she?"
"No," Oliver said grimly. "She did not. Must have telephoned her editor right after she got back to the Cove Inn last night. The editor, in turn, must have moved heaven and earth to get the story on the front page in time for today's edition."
"Ha," Chester said. "Well, Whispers is a small paper. Doubt if many people read it."
"They will read it today," Oliver said, "and by tomorrow morning the story will be in every paper in the country."
"Nah, Gloria Maitland wasn't a famous actress. She was just another pretty face who went to Hollywood to become a star. She didn't make it."
"True, but Nick Tremaine is fast becoming a household name, and he is mentioned in the piece." Chester started to look worried.
"How bad is the story?"
"The article states that Tremaine happens to be vacationing at the same hotel as the dead woman. But the big problem is that there is a thinly veiled reference to a rumor that Tremaine and Maitland once enjoyed a romantic liaison." Chester pursed his lips.
"That's not good."
"No," Oliver said, "it's not." Chester clapped him on the shoulder.
"Cheer up! Not the first time we've had a little scandal here at the hotel. It will all blow over in a day or two, you'll see. Just more publicity."
Oliver tossed his copy of Whispers down on the nearest workbench. It landed on top of the latest issue of Popular Science, Chester's favorite reading material. The cover of the magazine featured an artist's rendering of a futuristic war machine designed to navigate on land and sea.
"This isn't the kind of publicity the hotel needs," Oliver said.
Chester squinted thoughtfully.
"Are the police looking into the death of Miss Maitland?"
"I don't know. Haven't talked to Brandon this morning. He's a good man. I know he has his suspicions, but I'll be surprised if Chief Richards allows him to conduct a serious investigation."
Chester snorted. "Everyone knows that Richard owes his cushy job to the city council, and the council likes to pretend that there is no crime in Burning Cove. Bad for business."
"Right. So, unless Brandon comes up with some hard evidence, Maitland's death will go down as a tragic accident."
"How did the Burning Cove Herald cover the drowning?"
"As an accident, unsurprisingly. When was the last time the Herald covered anything in depth except charity luncheons and the thrilling activities of the Burning Cove Gardening Club?" Oliver said.
"You know, they say that once upon a time, Edwin Paisley used to be a red-hot crime reporter."
"Well, he's obviously retired from that line of journalism."
Chester picked up the copy of Whispers and quickly scanned the front page story. He paused at one line, squinting a little.
"What's this about a quote from the proprietor of the Burning Cove Hotel?"
"Don't remind me," Oliver said.
"You actually gave that reporter lady a quote?"
"Her name is Irene Glasson, and I didn't exactly give her a quote. What I tried to do was warn her off the story. I told her that if she wasn't careful, the police might conclude that she had something to do with Maitland's death."
"Looks like you didn't do a very good job of scaring the daylights out of her."
"No," Oliver said. "Apparently not."
He brooded over his impressions of Irene. He didn't have to dredge up the memories. He had been thinking about her non-stop since the moment he met her. That had occurred last night when Tom O'Connor, the head of hotel security, summoned him to the spa chamber. Irene was soaking wet, shivering in the cool night air. Someone had given her a towel which she had wrapped around her shoulders. She had clutched it closed in front of herself with one hand. In her other hand she gripped a handbag that looked like something a professional woman would carry. Her whisky brown hair hung in damp tendrils. Her wide-legged trousers and thin blouse were plastered to her slender frame. Aware that Irene was both the only eyewitness and the principal suspect, Oliver had whisked her into his private villa before any of the guests could see her. At that point, Jean Firebrace, the head of housekeeping, had taken charge of her for a while. The two women disappeared upstairs to the guest bedroom, a room that, until that moment, had never housed a guest. The next time Oliver saw Irene, she was bundled up in a thick white robe and ensconced in one of the two big chairs in front of the fireplace. What had surprised him the most was that he found it difficult to read her. He was usually very good when it came to figuring out what made someone tick. He could pick out a stranger in an audience and come up with an accurate character analysis in a few short minutes. All it took were some key questions and a quick study of the individual's clothes, jewelry, and voice. It was amazing how much you could tell about someone from just a pair of shoes. One thing had been clear from the start. He was damned sure that Irene didn't trust him. But for some reason, that just made her all the more interesting. There were secrets hidden in her big eyes, and a haunted quality that told him she had learned some things the hard way.
"Well, that gives us something in common, lady."
She would never have survived a casting call in Hollywood, because, with the exception of her fine eyes, everything else about her was too subtle for the camera. She was attractive, but not spectacularly so. She had an edge, though, an intensity that aroused his curiosity. He was very sure that, like with any good illusion, there was a lot hidden under the surface of Irene Glasson. By the time he had limped back to the villa, after seeing her off in her nondescript Ford sedan, he concluded that he was more than merely curious. He was downright fascinated. He probably ought to be worried by his reaction to her, he thought.
So where is this famous quote from the management?
Chester asked, scanning the article.
It's somewhere near the end of the piece, and I told you it's not a quote.
Ah, here we go, Chester said. The management of the Burning Cove Hotel refused to respond to this reporter's request for clarification.
In other words, I wouldn't confirm that Nick Tremaine was staying in the hotel or that he was rumored to have had an affair with the dead woman.
Which is as good as telling her straight out that he was here and that he probably did have an affair with Maitland.
Miss Glasson already knew that much. Chester did not look up from the article.
I wouldn't worry about it if I were you. It's just the usual Hollywood gossip.
Except for the reporter's speculation about the possibility of murder.
Except for that part. Where's the stuff about how the reporter had to jump into the pool to escape the killer?
She left out that bit of drama. Chester frowned.
Wonder why?
Probably because she wants to keep the attention on the death of Gloria Maitland. She's convinced it was murder.
Why is she so determined to prove it? Just to get the story?
I don't think so. He had been asking himself the same question since Irene Glasson had landed, soaking wet in his otherwise well-organized, well-controlled world.
Got a feeling there's more to it than that. She says she needs the story in order to keep her job. But I have a hunch she's got another reason. Something personal.
Something personal involving murder? That strikes me as peculiar.
Strikes me the same way.
Well, you're usually damned good at reading people.
I've been known to make mistakes, Oliver reminded him grimly.
True, but I think that in this case the odds are excellent that you're right.
Chester read some more of the article.
Says here that the hotel management is expected to go to great lengths to suppress any whisper of murder in order to avoid a scandal.
Strangely enough, I don't think she believed me when I told her that I intend to find out exactly what happened to Maitland.
Chester tossed the paper aside.
Miss Glasson doesn't know you very well.
No, Oliver said. She doesn't.
As if you'd let someone get away with murder right here on the grounds of your own hotel.
Damn right. The Burning Cove doesn't set a very high bar when it comes to the behavior expected of its guests, but management does frown on murder.
Gotta have some standards, Chester said.
Right. Besides, murder is bad for business.
When the Amazing Oliver Ward show was touring, we used to say that any publicity was good publicity, so long as it mentioned the next appearance.
We're not on the road anymore.
Chester took off his spectacles and began to polish the lenses with a large handkerchief.
No one's got a better eye for detail than you do. Part of what made you a good magician. What do you think happened in that spa chamber last night?
I took another look around this morning. It's just barely possible that Gloria Maitland slipped on the tiles at the edge of the pool and somehow managed to hit the back of her head and tumble into the water. But I doubt that's what happened. The angle of the blow makes it a lot more likely that she was struck from behind, probably knocked out cold. I'd say that she fell into the water and drowned.
So, she was murdered.
That's what it looks like.
Chester's bushy gray brows climbed.
Any chance it was the reporter lady who did it?
If I were a cop, I'd consider Miss Glasson an excellent suspect. She admitted that she had a private late-night meeting with the victim. Also, she's strong for a woman. She could have overpowered Gloria Maitland.
What makes you say Glasson is strong?
She was able to swim across the pool fully dressed.
Granted, she had the sense to get rid of her shoes first. Still, swimming in a pair of women's trousers wouldn't have been easy. Lots of heavy fabric. Then she managed to haul herself up out of the water when she reached the opposite side. There was something else as well.
What?
She had a large handbag. Looked a bit like a small version of a doctor's medical bag.
What about it? Women usually carry a handbag.
She hurled it across the lap pool before she went into the water.
Huh!
Chester reflected briefly.
You think it's odd that she didn't just drop the handbag when she kicked off her shoes, don't you?
I think there was something very important inside that handbag.
Money, probably, as well as the usual fripperies women carry around.
Whatever it was so important that she made a point of trying to save it before she went into the water. Oliver paused, thinking. It looked heavy.
The handbag? Chester grimaced. In my experience, the average woman's bag is as heavy as one of my tool kits. Anything else strike you?
Lots of things. Irene Glasson is shaping up to be a regular mystery woman. I heard her give Brandon her address in L.A. and the name of her landlady.
And?
I called the landlady this morning, said I was a relative who was hoping to speak to my long-lost cousin. The landlady didn't seem to know much about Irene Glasson, just that she had appeared on the doorstep a few months ago looking to rent an apartment. She had enough money for the first month's rent, so the landlady didn't ask a lot of questions.
Did you call the Whispers office?
Sure. Got right through to the editor, Velma Lancaster, who confirmed that Miss Glasson works for her. But that was about all she said. She sounded worried. When I told her who I was, she got even more nervous.
That's no surprise. So what it boils down to is that you really didn't learn much about Miss Glasson.
Irene Glasson does not appear to have a past. All the evidence indicates that her life began 4 months ago when she showed up in L.A.
She wouldn't be the first person to arrive in California looking for a fresh start. Take yourself, for example, and me. And most of the people who worked in the amazing Oliver Ward show.
Yeah, for example. But we all have pasts. Irene Glasson doesn't.
Chester's expression tightened with concern.
You think she's going to be trouble, don't you?
She already is trouble. The question is, what do I do about her?
Damned if I'll let her destroy this hotel. Every nickel I've got is tied up in this place. You got a plan?
The plan is to figure out what happened to Gloria Maitland.
Chester eyed him with a shrewd look.
What else do you have in mind?
I'd really like to know what Irene Glasson has inside her handbag.
Chapter 7.
The Maitland bitch wasn't supposed to become a problem.
Nick Tremaine tossed the copy of Whispers down on the table.
What the hell went wrong?
I don't know.
Claudia Picton clutched her notebook to her bosom and tried to contain her anxiety. Her job depended on keeping the star calm.
Mr. Ogden assured me that everything was under control.
Nick stabbed an accusing finger at her.
Well, that's not the case, is it? He said. The piece in Whispers says that Maitland and I were rumored to have had an affair, and that I'd recently ended the romance. Everyone who reads that story will assume that Maitland followed me here to Burning Cove, that she threatened to make trouble for me. And it's all true, damn it. Talk about a motive for a murder.
I'm sure everything will be all right, Claudia said. She was practically pleading now. The police are calling Miss Maitland's death a tragic accident. No one has labeled it murder.
No one except a third-rate gossip rag. That's all it takes.
I telephoned Mr. Ogden again a few minutes ago, Claudia said, striving for a soothing tone. He said there's nothing to be concerned about. He said you are to go on with your vacation here in Burning Cove as though nothing happened. He says if you check out before you were scheduled to leave, it will only stir up more speculation.
Nick gave her a savage glare and then stalked across the villa's main room, stopping at the glass doors that opened onto a private patio.
The outdoor sitting area was enclosed with a walled garden. A sweeping view of the cove and the Pacific Ocean beyond was visible through the decorative wrought iron. The glare of the light dancing and flashing on the surface of the water was so bright it hurt Claudia's eyes. The knowledge that Nick was seething was more than enough to tighten her already strained nerves to the breaking point. She had a job that almost any other woman in America would gladly have sold her soul to obtain. She was Nick Tremaine's personal assistant. If only those other women knew the truth. Her dream job had become a nightmare. He had been a supporting player in his first film, Sea of Shadows, but he managed to steal every scene in which he appeared. He'd been cast as the lead in his second film, Fortune's Rogue. The movie catapulted him to instant stardom. The gossip magazines couldn't get enough of him. Female fans adored him. There are rumors that Stanley Bancroft, the star who had been expecting to get top billing in the film, was drinking heavily and turning to cocaine to alleviate his depression.
Ogden was supposed to deal with Maitland before she made real trouble, Nick said.
He gazed grimly at the view through the open doors. Claudia watched him carefully, trying to gauge his mood. Stars were notoriously temperamental, and Nick Tremaine was no exception. The disconcerting thing was that he could switch from laughter to rage in the blink of an eye. It was part of his talent, but it was also unnerving.
"Mr. Ogden said that he gave Miss Maitland the money she demanded," Claudia said. "He was certain that she would disappear."
"But she didn't disappear, did she?"
Nick did not turn around.
"Instead, she followed me here to Burning Cove. And now she's dead, and that damned reporter from Whispers has as good as implied I'm a murderer."
"Mr. Ogden said that the hotel management would protect you from the press. The studio will take care of everything else."
"Easy for Ogden to say. It's not his future on the line. What am I supposed to do for the next 2 weeks? Hang around the hotel pool and drink martinis while I duck the press? Or maybe I should schedule a massage. That would certainly make for some interesting gossip, don't you think? I can see the headline. Actor enjoys attentions of lovely masseuse in spa where his lover drowned."
"I'm sure everything will be all right. Mr. Ogden will deal with the police and the hotel management. He'll take care of the editor of Whispers, too. That's his job. The studio pays him to fix problems like this. He knows what he's doing. I'm sure he's handled far worse situations."
"Worse than accusation of murder?" Nick swung around. "Ogden is powerful in L.A., but we're in Burning Cove. Things may be different here."
"I'm sure that's not true," Claudia said quickly. "Money talks, and Mr. Ogden has the resources of the studio behind him. He can buy off the L.A. police and judges. He can certainly afford the Burning Cove cops."
"I refuse to sit here in this villa while that Whispers reporter sabotages my career. I've worked too hard to get this far. Damned if I'll stand by and let that glassing bitch destroy me."
Claudia clenched her fingers very tightly around her notebook.
"What do you want me to do?"
Nick looked at her with blazing eyes. Unlike many of Hollywood's leading men who got by on their looks and minimal talent, Nick was a genuinely gifted actor. He was endowed with an uncanny ability to project a variety of emotions, ranging from smoldering passion to bone-chilling fury. It didn't hurt that he was breathtakingly handsome, with a classically carved jaw, high cheekbones, and a trim, athletic physique. His dark hair was cut in the sleek, brushed-back style made fashionable by the likes of Cary Grant and Clark Gable. It gleamed with just the right amount of hair oil. The camera loved Nick. So did directors. So did women. Claudia was starting to think that women might prove to be Nick's downfall. The Hollywood magazines called him irresistible, and he had begun to believe his own press. The result was a string of one-night flings and short-lived affairs. It had been inevitable that sooner or later, a problem like Gloria Maitland would occur.
According to the rumors flying around this hotel, the reporter who wrote that story for Whispers is still here in town, Nick said. He sounded thoughtful now.
That's right, Claudia said, relieved that he appeared to be calming down. Mr. Ogden gave me the details. He got them from the local chief of police. Miss Glasson is registered at the Cove Inn.
Talk to her, Nick said. Offer her an exclusive. Shocked, Claudia stared at him.
I don't understand. What kind of exclusive?
An exclusive interview with me, you stupid woman. She'll jump at the opportunity to have a private conversation with Nick Tremaine. Any reporter would, especially under these circumstances.
Claudia swallowed hard. Do you think that's wise? Mr. Ogden instructed me to keep you away from the press.
Ogden is in L.A. I'm the one here in Burning Cove. It's my career at stake. I'll deal with the problem. Make that appointment for today.
She wanted to argue with him. The thought of going against Ogden's orders terrified her. But Nick Tremaine could easily get her fired if he decided that he didn't want her around. It dawned on her that the idea of an exclusive interview just might work. Nick could certainly turn on the charm when it suited him. There was no reason to think that he could not manipulate Irene Glasson.
I'll contact her right away, she said.
She whirled around and rushed toward the front door of the villa. When she was safely outside, she stopped and took several deep breaths of the warm, fragrant air. There had been a little fog earlier, but it had been burned off by the late September sun. Now the sky was an unreal shade of blue. When her nerves had settled down, she made her way along a flagstone path that wound through the lush gardens of the hotel. Nick had one of the private villas, Casa de Oro, but her room was in the main building. The villas, with their secluded patios and gardens and dramatic views, were reserved for the stars and others willing to pay top dollar for luxury and privacy. The Burning Cove Hotel crowned a gently rising hillside above the rocky cliffs. At the foot of the cliffs, splashing waves churned up white froth on a pristine beach. The main building and the villas were all constructed in a fantasy version of what they called the Spanish colonial revival style of architecture. From what she had seen, the entire town, houses, hotels, shops, even the post office and the gas stations, had been built according to the same set of design rules. White stucco walls, red tile roofs, charming shaded courtyards, and covered walkways were everywhere. Burning Cove was a Hollywood movie set of a town, she thought. And just like a movie, you never really knew what was going on behind the scenes. She decided that she hated the place.
Chapter 8. We scooped up every paper in town with a Maitland story, Velma Lancaster said. The words crackled a little over the phone line. But by now, half the reporters in Los Angeles will be on the way to Burning Cove. You need to get me a follow-up headline for tomorrow morning's edition.
Irene winced and held the phone away from her ear. When Velma got excited, she tended to talk very, very fast, and she got very, very loud. She was definitely excited this morning. Gloria Maitland's death, with its connection to Nick Tremaine and a legendary hotel known to be the haunt of Hollywood royalty, was the biggest story Whispers had ever printed. Velma had just spent 5 minutes of long-distance phone time emphasizing that it was also the most dangerous. 40-something and constructed along Amazonian proportions, Velma had taken control of the sleepy little paper 2 years earlier, when her much older husband had collapsed and died at his desk. Irene had no difficulty summoning up a mental image of her new employer. An outsized woman with a personality to match,
Velma coloured her hair scarlet red and styled it in a short, sharply angled bob that had gone out of fashion several years earlier. She wore exotically patterned caftans, smoked cigars, and kept a bottle of whiskey in the bottom drawer of her desk.
"Don't worry," Irene said. "I'm working on a headline for you."
She lowered her voice because she was using the front desk phone in the lobby of the Cove Inn. Mildred Fordyce, the grey-haired proprietor, was puttering around behind the counter, doing her best to make it appear that she wasn't paying attention. But Irene knew she was hanging on every word.
"Call me as soon as you have something I can print," Velma rasped.
"I will, but it's not going to be easy," Irene said. "The Burning Cove Hotel has tighter security than most banks."
"So what? Banks get robbed all the time. Do your job."
"Yes, boss, but there's another problem."
"Now what?"
"I only plan to spend one night here in Burning Cove," Irene said. Automatically, she glanced down at the calf-length skirt and flutter-sleeved blouse she was wearing. "I just brought a single change of clothes with me. Housekeeping at the Burning Cove Hotel took the things I was wearing last night when I went in the pool. I haven't seen them since. I'm not sure if they survived."
"Reversing the charges for phone calls is one thing, but if you think I'm going to pay for a new wardrobe, you can think again. Go rob a bank."
Time to play her high card, Irene decided.
"This is about Peggy, boss. Her death wasn't an accident. We both know that."
There was a short, taut silence on the other end of the line.
"You don't have to remind me," Velma said finally.
She sounded gruff but worried.
"Promise me you'll be careful. I don't want to lose another reporter. Whispers is a Hollywood gossip paper. We care about which actors are sleeping with which actresses. We don't cover murder."
"Except when one of our own is a victim."
Velma heaved a sigh.
"Agreed."
"We need to follow up on this story, boss."
10 days ago, Peggy Hackett had drowned in her own bathtub. The death was called an accident. For years, she had been a Hollywood legend, the gossip columnist of one of the biggest papers in L.A. Peggy had also been a chain-smoking, martini-swilling reporter who, in her younger days, had been known to sleep with her sources, male and female, in order to get a story. As her looks began to fail, she had not been above using leverage, as she termed it, to convince people to talk. In the end, the drinking and hard living had exacted a toll. She was fired from the newspaper that had carried her column for so long. 6 months ago, she wound up on the doorstep of Whispers. Velma hired her. Peggy had gained some control over the drinking, but she was no longer young enough or pretty enough to seduce her old sources. Most of the insider secrets that she had once used as leverage had become old news involving faded stars. But she had been determined to rebuild her career. It was Peggy who had convinced Velma to hire Irene in spite of her lack of experience. "Glasson's got the grit," Peggy had argued. "That's what matters. Reminds me of myself when I was just starting out. Hell, I can teach her everything else she needs to know." Theirs had been an odd relationship, Irene thought, jaded and afflicted with a chronic cough. Peggy had seemed to gain a new lease on life when she undertook the task of mentoring Irene.
"I owe you, Glasson," she had said more than once.
"I owe you, Peggy. You were a friend when I needed one."
"All right," Velma said. "Follow the story, but just be damned careful."
"Don't worry, I will," Irene promised.
But she was speaking to a dead line. Velma had hung up on her. She set the receiver back in the cradle and gave Mildred Fordyce a bright smile.
"Don't worry," she said. "I reversed the charges."
Mildred turned around beaming and studied Irene with rapt attention.
"So, you're the reporter who found the body of that poor woman last night."
"I see you read Whispers."
"Not until today."
Mildred said cheerfully. "But I picked up a copy at the newsstand this morning, after I saw the front page of the local paper. Can't rely on the Herald to give you the whole story, not when the story involves Oliver Ward's hotel."
She pushed a copy of the Burning Cove Herald across the desk, turning it around so that Irene could read the headline. Tragic accident at local hotel.
"Yes, I saw the piece that ran in the Herald," Irene said. "You're right. It's not the whole story, not by a country mile. More like a small obituary notice."
Mildred tapped the front page of the Herald.
"According to this, that woman's death was accidental. It says the cops think she slipped and fell on some wet tiles, cracked her head and went into the pool. Probably unconscious, so she drowned."
"That does seem to be the prevailing theory at the moment," Irene said.
Mildred got a speculative expression.
"But the article in Whispers claims that there was someone else in the spa."
"There was someone else there," Irene said. "I didn't get a good look, but I heard him, or her."
"You couldn't tell whether it was a man or a woman?"
"No. It was quite dark, and sounds get distorted in that big tiled room."
"How do you know that person killed Gloria Maitland?"
"I don't know for sure," Irene admitted. "But I think that under the circumstances, the situation warrants a full investigation."
"You mean because Miss Maitland had an affair with Nick Tremaine, and because rumor has it that he ended things, and because Tremaine just happened to be staying at the Burning Cove Hotel at the time of the death?"
"I see you read my story very carefully."
"Yes, indeed," Mildred said.
"There was someone else in the spa last night," Irene said. "I think that at the very least the police should find and interview that individual. Don't you?"
Mildred pursed her lips.
"I'm afraid it's not going to be that simple. This is Burning Cove."
"You mean the authorities here are as corrupt as they are back in L.A.?"
"You didn't hear me say that."
Mildred raised one shoulder in a dismissive shrug.
"According to the Herald, the lady who discovered the body was very upset. It says she was likely suffering from a case of shattered nerves."
"Do I look like I'm suffering from a case of bad nerves?"
"No," Mildred admitted. "What are you going to do next?"
"I'm here to cover a story," Irene said. "That's what I intend to do."
"We'll see. Good luck to you is all I can say."
Chapter 9.
"What is it with actors?"
Ernest Ogden tossed the copy of Whispers onto his desk, got to his feet, and walked to the window.
"They're all the same, I swear. The hotter the star, the more likely he is to get into trouble. If only their brains matched their looks and their talent. Damned fools, all of them. Pardon my language, Miss Ross."
Maxine Ross glanced up from her stenography notebook.
"Of course, Mr. Ogden."
As usual, she was cool and unruffled. It was, after all, not the first time she had heard the lament about temperamental, neurotic actors or a bit of rough language. She was a professional. She also happened to be one of the few females employed by the studio who had never had aspirations to become a star. She was unflappable. A steady, calming influence in a business built on overheated passions, dreams, ambitions, and too much money. Glumly, Ogden contemplated the scene outside his second-floor office window. From where he stood, he could see an array of large, enclosed sound stages, the commissary and the wardrobe department. Beyond was the big backlot used for outdoor scenes. That week, they were filming a western, a staple of the business. You could always sell westerns, Ogden thought. The facade of a frontier town had been set up. A saloon, the sheriff's office, the bank that was destined to be robbed, and a general store. And all of it fake. That was the movie business for you. It sold illusions. He did love it so.
The whole establishment, from backlot to executive offices, was, in effect, a secure compound surrounded by high walls. Access was controlled through high, ornate gates, manned by tough security guards. Theoretically, the walls and the guards were there to protect the privacy of the stars and prevent interference with the filmmaking process. But sometimes it felt as if he worked for a fancy prison or a secret government agency. He was a very well-paid nanny to a bunch of spoiled actors and actresses. He routinely saved prominent talents who went on drinking binges and got involved in hit-and-run incidents. He made morals charges against actors with a fondness for underage sex partners disappear. He paid off women who claimed a star had raped them or that they were pregnant with a star's love child. He hushed up rumors of homosexuality. And so it went. He could fix just about any problem that came up.
"What's done is done," he said. "Nick Tremaine is very important to the studio, so obviously we will have to clean up this mess."
"Yes, sir,"
Maxine said. She waited, pen poised above her notebook. Ogden considered his options. He lived by three simple rules. Rule number one, identify the problem. Rule number two, identify the source of the problem. Rule number three, identify the pressure points and apply whatever pressure was required to make a problem disappear. Most of the time, money was all that was needed. Money persuaded cops and judges to look the other way. Money persuaded women to cease making accusations of rape. Money kept blackmailers quiet. But sometimes more forceful measures were required.
"The problem, Miss Ross, is that a gossip columnist has published completely false rumors about Nick Tremaine in a cheap Hollywood scandal sheet."
"Yes, Mr. Ogden."
"The source of the problem would appear to be the reporter who wrote the piece, Irene Glasson."
"Yes, sir."
"Get the editor of Whispers on the phone for me. It's time that Velma Lancaster and I had a little chat."
"Yes, Mr. Ogden. Will that be all, sir?"
"No. Tremaine's personal assistant called again this morning. He told me that Tremaine is very nervous. Nervous stars are always a problem. They become even more temperamental and unpredictable than they usually are."
"Yes, sir."
Ogden turned around.
"Get a hold of Hollywood Mac, too. Tell him to stand by. I might have a job for him."
"Yes, sir."
Maxine rose, unfazed by the instructions to contact a man who consorted with shady characters and known criminals. She left, closing the door very quietly. Ogden went back to the window and watched a familiar limousine pull up to the big gate. The driver flashed a badge at the guard and was waved through. It wasn't that long ago that the arrival of Stanley Bancroft, the star of Sea of Shadows, would have created a buzz of excitement on the grounds of the studio. But today, few people bothered to look at the big car. Bancroft was not yet box office poison, but everyone knew that his career was fading fast. "All glory is fleeting, my friend," Ogden thought. A few years earlier, at the dawn of talking movies, Bancroft had displaced another leading man, who, as it turned out, had a high, grating voice. That hadn't been a problem during the heyday of the silence, but it was a career killer in the era of sound. Ogden turned away from the window and sat down at his desk. He thought about the various steps he could take to control the damage that threatened one of the studio's most important investments. After a while, he came up with a plan. "This is why you get the big bucks in the corner office, pal." But he knew that long ago it had ceased to be about the money. What he truly relished these days was the power that he wielded. It was more intoxicating than any drug. Chapter 10. It was his job to protect the star. That's what friends are for, Henry Oakes reminded himself. He sat at the counter of the small cafe, hunched over a cup of coffee and a copy of Whispers, and contemplated the task that he had set for himself. The problem was that Nick Tremaine did not understand he was in danger. Henry wanted to warn him, but he didn't dare reveal himself. The time was not right. It should have been the studio's job to protect Nick Tremaine, but whoever was in charge of his security was obviously not paying attention. The studio had missed the threat that the first Whispers reporter, Hackett, had presented. They had not dealt with the Gloria Maitland problem. Henry had talked to both women, tried to reason with them, but they had treated him as if he was crazy. Hackett had actually called him crazy to his face. It had reminded him of his mother's words. "You have to stop obsessing over movie stars, Henry. People will think you're not right in the head." One thing was certain. Neither the Maitland woman nor the nosy newspaper reporter, Hackett, would call him crazy again. With them out of the picture, it had appeared that Nick Tremaine was safe, at least for a time. But now another reporter from Whispers had arrived on the scene, and it was obvious that Irene Glasson posed a serious threat to the star. Henry folded the copy of Whispers very carefully so that the terrible headline was concealed. Nick Tremaine was not the first star with whom he'd shared a special kind of friendship. Before he had developed the relationship with Tremaine, he was very close to another leading man, but the studio had come between them. Two goons found him outside the star's home one night. They had hurt him badly, beaten him nearly senseless. They told him that if he ever got close to the star again, they would kill him. He believed them. For a while, he tried to avoid having any more close friendships with stars, but he couldn't resist the movies, and one afternoon he'd gone to see Fortune's Rogue. He'd been transported by the power of Nick Tremaine's acting. By the time he left the theatre, he'd understood that he and Tremaine were destined to share a special relationship. He'd also comprehended that this time he had to be careful. He could not allow the studio to discover his friendship with the star. Nick Tremaine would be forced to deny it. So, for Tremaine's sake, he had remained in the shadows. Someday, when the time was right, he would reveal himself to Tremaine. But until that day, he would do what he was meant to do. He would protect his friend, the star. Chapter 11. Irene was in her room trying to come up with another hook for the next story when Mildred Fordyce bellowed from the bottom of the stairs.
"Someone is here to see you, Miss Glasson."
Oliver Ward. It had to be him. Irene couldn't think of anyone else in Burning Cove who might want to speak with her. A little rush of anticipation swept through her. She told herself it was because a visit from Ward boded well for her story. Perhaps he had decided to give her a real quote after all. But a small secret voice whispered that it wasn't just the prospect of getting a useful quote that made her hurry to the door. The truth was that she was very, very curious to see Oliver Ward again. It would be interesting to find out whether her initial impressions of him held up in the light of day, or if she had allowed her imagination to mislead her last night. She opened the door and leaned out into the upstairs hall.
"I'll be right down, Mrs. Fordyce."
She closed the door again and hurried back across the room to check her image in the mirror. After returning to the inn last night, she had made the phone call to Velma and then gone upstairs. She had been energized and feeling jumpy, but she took the time to pin several big curls into her damp hair before collapsing onto the bed. Now she was very glad she had done so. At least she no longer looked like she had been dunked in a pool. She certainly wouldn't be mistaken for Ginger Rogers or Katharine Hepburn, but she looked presentable, with her hair brushed back off her face and tucked behind her ears. The soft, easy waves fell to her shoulders. She put on some lipstick, took a deep breath, and went out into the hall. It wasn't Oliver Ward who was waiting in the lobby. A tall, thin woman in her early 20s looked up as Irene came down the stairs. The newcomer wore a severely cut brown suit with a narrow, calf-length skirt and a tight jacket that did little to enhance her figure. Her dark hair was parted in the middle and pinned in a tightly rolled set of curls that started at one ear and looped down around the back of her neck to end at the other ear. It was a very business-like hairstyle. She clutched a notebook as though it were a life preserver. Irene's first thought was that the woman would have been quite pretty if she didn't look so anxious.
"Miss Irene Glasson?"
the woman asked. The voice fit with the rest of the image, thin and nervous. "I'm Irene Glasson." Irene tried to sound cool and professional. She was a journalist now. The new role was not so very different from her previous career as a private secretary. Success in both fields, she had discovered, depended on organizational skills and the ability to think on one's feet. "What can I do for you, miss?" The woman looked almost pathetically relieved.
"Picton, Claudia Picton. I'm Mr. Tremaine's personal assistant. I wonder if I might have a word with you. It's very important."
"What is this about?" Irene asked, but she was sure she knew the answer. Excitement splashed through her. Claudia cast a quick, uneasy look at Mildred and then lowered her voice.
"I'm afraid it's a private matter."
"Of course," Irene said. "My room is too small. There's only one chair. Let's go out on the patio. We can talk there." Ignoring Mildred's disappointed expression, she went quickly toward the glass-paned doors that opened onto a small garden. Claudia followed, practically trotting. Irene motioned toward two green wrought iron chairs shaded by an awning. Claudia hesitated and then perched on the edge of one of the chairs. Irene sat down across from her.
"How did you find me, Miss Picton?"
Claudia flinched and then reddened. She made a visible effort to square her already rigid shoulders.
"Someone at the studio gave me your name," she said.
Irene nodded.
"Of course, that explains it." "I beg your pardon?"
"You're here because you were assigned to handle Nick Tremaine's little public relations problem. Some fixer at the studio made a phone call to the local police and offered a nice gratuity in exchange for the address of the reporter who broke the story of Gloria Maitland's death. Obviously, the helpful local policeman obliged." Claudia's jaw tensed.
"I did get a call from someone who represents the studio, but I'm here because Mr. Tremaine himself asked me to speak with you."
"Did he? That's very interesting. What is he going to offer me in exchange for dropping the story?"
"You don't understand. He wants to give you an exclusive one-on-one interview."
"That's very generous of him. Why would he do that?"
"Mr. Tremaine feels that there has been a grave misunderstanding concerning his prior association with Miss Maitland. He would like to clarify the nature of his relationship with her."
"That should be interesting. Naturally, I'll be delighted to conduct an interview with Mr. Tremaine, provided he understands that everything will be on the record."
"I'll make sure he knows that before he meets with you."
Claudia paused.
"You do realize that Mr. Tremaine was nowhere near the spa last night at the time of Miss Maitland's death."
Irene caught her breath, but managed to maintain what she thought was a serviceable air of unconcern.
"Is that so?" she said.
"He was at the Paradise Club," Claudia said. "It's a popular night spot here in Burning Cove. He was seen by any number of people. The police will be able to confirm that if they feel it necessary to do so."
"Damn," Irene thought. That was not good news. "In that case, there is no reason for Mr. Tremaine to be concerned about an investigation into the death of Miss Maitland, is there?" she said.
"I hope you will try to understand his situation," Claudia said. "Mr. Tremaine has no reason to be concerned about an appearance of guilt, but he and Miss Maitland were acquainted."
"Well acquainted, apparently. Can you confirm that they had a romantic liaison?"
No, nothing like that. Mr. Tremaine, consider Miss Maitland to be a friend, that's all. And because of that friendship, he doesn't want to see her reputation impugned.
Miss Maitland is dead. She is no longer concerned about her reputation.
I would hope you would consider her family's feelings in this matter.
She has no close family, Irene said. I checked. Claudia leaped to her feet. She was thoroughly flustered now.
I think it would be best if Mr. Tremaine himself explained the nature of his association with Miss Maitland.
I agree. I'll look forward to the interview. When and where?
Mr. Tremaine asked me to invite you to meet with him in his villa at the Burning Cove Hotel.
Irene almost smiled. I don't think that would be a very good idea under the circumstances. Appearances, you know. Claudia froze. It was clear that she had not expected the invitation to be refused.
You don't want the interview?
She asked. I want the interview, but I would prefer to conduct it somewhere other than Nick Tremaine's private hotel suite. Claudia looked stricken.
I don't understand. Surely you aren't afraid of Mr. Tremaine?
Let's just say I would be more comfortable if the interview were conducted out in the open. I'd prefer a location where there will be other people around. That way, if Mr. Tremaine tries to threaten me or offer a bribe, I can round up a couple of witnesses. Claudia was torn between shock and outrage.
That's ridiculous! Mr. Tremaine just wants to tell you his side of the story.
Which I will be only too happy to hear. I suggest we meet for coffee at one of the local cafes.
I'm afraid that would be too difficult to arrange. Mr. Tremaine is famous. He can't just walk into a cafe and expect to go unrecognized. He would soon be surrounded by a crowd of people wanting his autograph. The reason he stays at the Burning Cove Hotel is precisely because he knows he can expect that his privacy will be respected.
Irene shrugged. All right, I'll meet with him at the hotel, but not in his villa. I want a more public location. And keep in mind that it might not be easy to arrange for me to get through the front gate of the Burning Cove. I understand management has a strict policy when it comes to members of the press. Evidently, journalists are not allowed on the premises.
I'm sure the hotel management will make an exception for Mr. Tremaine, Claudia said. Would this afternoon be convenient for you?
Certainly.
I suggest 3 o'clock. You and Mr. Tremaine could meet for tea in the garden room at the Burning Cove Hotel.
I'll be there at 3. If you don't see me, it will be because I couldn't get past the guards at the gate.
Don't worry. I'll take care of that end of things. Thank you, Miss Glasson. You won't regret this, I promise you.
Irene gave her a cool smile. I'm sure you didn't expect me to turn down an interview with Nick Tremaine. Claudia looked pathetically grateful.
To be honest, I didn't know what to expect. Miss Maitland's death has been so upsetting for everyone, especially Mr. Tremaine. 3 o'clock.
Claudia turned and fled back into the lobby. Irene waited a moment before she opened her handbag and took out her notebook. She unclipped the pencil and started to jot down her impressions of Claudia Picton. Nervous? Anxious? Scared? I know how you feel, Claudia Picton. I've been nervous, anxious, and scared for the past 4 months. She had driven some 3,000 miles, traded her prize packet for a far more anonymous car, changed her name, changed her career, and invented a new life. But she was still looking over her shoulder, still listening for footsteps in the night, still jumping at shadows. Finding another body last night certainly hadn't helped soothe her nerves. 3 women whose lives had touched hers were dead within 4 months. Helen Spencer, Peggy Hackett, and Gloria Maitland. Logic and common sense told her that the deaths of Peggy Hackett and Gloria Maitland could not possibly be connected to the grisly murder of Helen Spencer. But logic and common sense did little to allay the fear that churned deep inside her. It was fear of a link between the 3 dead women that had caused her to become obsessed with finding out the truth about Peggy Hackett's death. So be it, she thought. She had run as far as she could, all the way to the opposite edge of the country. There was nowhere else to run. She had to discover the truth for the sake of her own sanity. A large shadow fell across the open page of her notebook.
"I doubt that she'll last very long," Oliver said.
Irene was so startled she nearly levitated out of her chair. She took a sharp breath and looked up. Oliver was standing slightly behind her, his cane gripped tightly in one hand. She should have heard him approach, she thought. She had been so lost in her own thought that she hadn't heard the tapping of his cane or the hitch in his stride. She glanced down and saw that there was a thick rubber cap on the end of the cane. That, no doubt, explained why she hadn't heard it thumping on the paving stones of the patio. Oliver had moved very quietly for a man with a bad leg. The word stealthy came to mind. He was dressed in a pair of excellently tailored trousers, a crisply pressed shirt, and a lightweight linen jacket, cut in the drape style. The fashion had become very popular because the design emphasized the width of a man's upper chest and shoulders. But Oliver didn't need the illusion created by a good tailor, she thought. His shoulders would have looked good with or without the jacket. It occurred to her that the style had something else going for it. The slightly angled drape of the fabric above the waistline was far less restrictive than the older style, which fit the body quite snugly. The ease of movement allowed by the new fashion probably appealed to a man who needed to use a cane. "I didn't hear you," she said. She knew the comment sounded like a thinly veiled accusation.
"Sorry," he said. "Didn't mean to startle you. Do you mind if I join you?"
"No," she said. She slipped the pencil into her notebook and closed the cover. He eased into the chair that Claudia had just vacated. Irene watched the small action carefully, trying to determine if he really did need the cane, or if he used it as a prop. As if an otherwise healthy specimen of manhood would deliberately go about with a fake limp, she thought. I'm suspicious of everyone these days.
"Was that shorthand you were using to record your notes?" Oliver asked.
She tensed. "Every reporter develops his or her own version of shorthand."
"I know, but I've seen notes made by other journalists. They aren't nearly so neat."
Oliver smiled faintly.
"Not so impossible to decipher, either. I'm guessing that only another trained stenographer could read your notes."
He was fishing for information about her. "That's the thing about a private code, isn't it?" she said. "No one else can read it. What did you mean when you said that Claudia Picton wouldn't last very long?"
"I assume you've met other studio publicists and assistants."
"Sure. Usually on the phone, though."
"Still, you must know what they're like."
"They're your best friends when they want coverage for their stars, and your worst enemies if you don't print the kind of coverage they want." Oliver's mouth curved faintly in wry amusement.
"Exactly. Reporters aren't the only ones who have to deal with publicists and assistants. The hotel has to handle them all the time."
"Yes, I'm sure you've had a lot of experience with the species."
"The appeal of the Burning Cove Hotel is based in part on the fact that it has become a fashionable retreat for famous film stars. Ambitious publicists and assistants want their actors and actresses to be seen checking in, but they don't want photographers to catch the stars in compromising positions. The result is that my security staff exists primarily to make sure reporters and photographers don't get on the grounds without my permission."
"Which brings you to me."
"Yes, it does."
Oliver watched her with unreadable eyes.
"I couldn't help but overhear that last part of your conversation with Miss Picton. You have an appointment to meet with Tremaine at my hotel this afternoon."
"Yes, I do. I've been invited to conduct an exclusive interview with Tremaine over tea in something called the Garden Room. Will you allow me on the grounds, Mr. Ward?"
"You're welcome to do the interview in the Garden Room, but I wouldn't be too hopeful of getting anything useful out of Tremaine if I were you. He'll do his best to charm you. I understand he has a real talent for that sort of a thing."
I'm sure he'll try to dazzle me, but I'm not naive, Mr. Ward. I fully anticipate that Nick Tremaine will try to convince me that his former girlfriend's death was nothing more than a tragic accident. Oliver nodded, satisfied. A word of warning. He really is a very talented actor.
I know. I saw him in Fortune's Rogue.
I see. Well, in that case, good luck with the interview.
So you will allow me into your hotel?
Yes, Miss Glasson. You are free to come and go at will. All I ask in return is that you keep me updated on whatever you learn.
She thought about that for a few seconds and then nodded. Fair enough, so long as you let me know whatever you find out about Gloria Maitland's death.
Agreed. Oliver looked amused. Are you saying that you trust me, Miss Glasson?
She smiled her reassuring reporter smile, the one Peggy had taught her. Peggy had called it the just-the-two-of-us-chatting smile.
No more than you trust me, Mr. Ward, she said. However, as you pointed out last night, at the moment, we do seem to share some similar interests.
One of which is the security of my hotel. This morning I went over events with the head of my security department. We retraced your steps. As a rule, the spa chamber is locked at night, but there was no sign of forced entry. I assume the side door was unlocked when you arrived?
Yes.
Who unlocked it for you?
I assumed Miss Maitland unlocked it. She chose the spa as the location for our meeting. She said it would be empty at that hour of the night. Would it have been difficult for her to get her hands on the key?
Unfortunately, no, Oliver said. He sounded grim. There are several keys to the spa because various departments have reason to go in at various times. Housekeeping stocks the robes and towels. The maintenance people have a key, and several members of the spa staff have keys.
In other words, someone who wanted to borrow a key for a short time could probably figure out how to do it.
Yes. Oliver hesitated briefly. Something else has come up. My security people talked to the housekeeping staff.
Why?
The maids are one of the front lines when it comes to hotel security. No one ever notices them.
I see what you mean, Irene said.
One of the housekeepers witnessed what was evidently a very hot quarrel between Tremaine and Miss Maitland the day before Miss Maitland died. The maid didn't catch all the details, but Tremaine appeared to be threatening Maitland.
Very interesting, Irene said.
Oliver watched her intently for an endless moment.
What? She finally asked.
There is one other possibility that should be considered.
Irene did not move. Are you about to suggest that I stole the key?
It did occur to me.
For what it's worth, I didn't take it.
For what it's worth, Oliver said, I'm inclined to believe you.
Really? Why?
As far as I can tell, you had no motive to kill Gloria Maitland.
All I wanted from her was information.
As I said, I'm inclined to believe you.
Be still, my beating heart.
Oliver stretched out his bad leg and contemplated her with an unreadable expression. A shiver of knowing iced her nerves. He was waiting for her to make some small slip.
I'm sure you've heard that Nick Tremaine has a fairly good alibi for last night, she said. Miss Picton told me he was at a nightclub here in Burning Cove.
Oliver nodded. The Paradise Club.
You checked?
Last night after you left.
Miss Picton said that Tremaine spent the evening there and that several people saw him.
People who had been drinking heavily all evening are not the most reliable witnesses. But yes, it seems he was at the club for at least some portion of the night. Would you care to talk to someone who can provide more details?
Of course. She raised her brows. I take it you have a witness in mind.
The owner of the club, Luther Pell.
I would definitely like to ask him a few questions, although he has no reason to tell me the truth.
You don't trust anyone, do you?
She smiled a thin smile. Everyone has secrets, including you.